Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, two members of EXPO, Ex-Prisoners Organizing. They are formerly incarcerated people who are part of WISDOM, which links people of faith across Wisconsin to work for justice. EXPO is an increasingly powerful voice for reform. The lead organizer says the people closest to the program are the people who are closest to the solution. So this hour, we are going to address what most people would agree, be you wherever on the political spectrum, our mass incarceration program. And we're delighted to have in our studios two gentlemen who will talk about this, who have been working with EXPO for some time. Mark Rice chairs the Revocations Work Group. We'll talk about revocations during this hour of WISDOM. And he is the Assistant State Director of EXPO Wisconsin, a group of formerly incarcerated people who drive the criminal justice reform campaign for WISDOM. He also serves as a board member of Project Return, which helps men and women leaving prison make a positive and permanent return to the community. And he is a doctoral candidate at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Mark, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. He's got a radio voice to boot. Carl Fields is also with us. Carl is a board member of EXPO Wisconsin. He is the chair of Racine's Interfaith Coalition's Restore Our Communities Wisconsin Task Force. And we thank you very much, Carl, for being with us. We have a variety of issues to talk about this hour. Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So why is it important to have ex-offenders at the table? What can you tell us that people who haven't been on the inside don't know?
First of all, we're moving away from the term offender. Many people consider that term to be offensive and dehumanizing.
Really?
We prefer the term formerly incarcerated person or person with conviction record. So that's been a main focus of EXPO's changing the language around, changing language that people use to describe us. That's very important, and we're encouraging folks to use more humanizing language. We want everyone to view people with conviction arrest records as human beings, members of families, and assets to communities. Could you remind me of the question now? That caught my attention.
Is it that formerly incarcerated individuals can do to help us address the issue of mass incarceration that those who haven't been on the inside?
Right.
Yes. We believe that the people closest to the problem are closest to the solution, as you said. And it's essential that people who have been directly impacted by problems are leading campaigns around these problems, and we understand the problems and issues better than anyone else, and so we bring our experience to the table that is unique experience. And so in the past, oftentimes, formerly incarcerated people have been excluded from the policymaking process and excluded from conversations around reform and around transformation of the penal system.
Indeed.
And now EXPO is stepping up, and we're filling a huge gap that there was in the past. Now EXPO is leading the charge around these discussions. We have been very active since 2014. As you said, we're leading the Rock Wisconsin campaign, Restoring Our Communities campaign of WISDOM, which is a campaign that aims to cut Wisconsin's prison population in half. And that's very important and essential that we're included. We have a spot at the table, and people are listening to us, that we bring a unique perspective that is essential and all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. For me, Kathleen, I suppose it's a matter of being an impacted person, being an ex-incarcerated person. The policies, the practices, the way that they're carried out, the execution of them is a lot of times completely different from how they were written. And so many of us understand firsthand the lack of effectiveness of how they're carried out or how they're played out or how the resources tied to them actually get into the hands of the people or to the needs directly. So for us, we have that unique perspective, but we're not indifferent people to this issue. It isn't release from prison and go home and go about your day, or commit crimes and continue to go back. It's not a matter of either or on the extreme side for us. A lot of us want to come home and be citizens again, but we want to be embraced as citizens as well. And there are a lot of mechanisms in place that, you know, we refer to as barriers quite often that keep us from being that. And they're put in place in the name of public safety. And some people are receptive to our statements on the matter, but they say that because the policies in place, the practices are in place, they can't change them. So their hands are tied by them. So we need to be very much a part of the process from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with the whole process of who gets arrested. When you look at the statistics for the state of Wisconsin and the county of Milwaukee, they're pretty dramatic. That among African Americans, we lead the nation in the number of young men who are incarcerated. The percentage of young men in the city who are African American or Native American is very, very high when you compare it to the rest of the country. Why is that? What could be changed in that regard? Is there something unfair that's happening?
Yes. First of all, communities of color in Milwaukee are over-policed. That's where it starts. There are far too many police officers in many neighborhoods across Wisconsin, across Milwaukee. We know that many community members have been speaking out against some of the proposals on the table that would add more police to neighborhoods, and there's been a consensus now forming around Milwaukee that Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin need to invest more in the root causes of crime and address underlying issues like poverty, structural racism, public education, public transportation. Wisconsin should be investing in all of these systems and all of these different policy areas. All of this is going to reduce crime, and it's going to reduce the need for police. So for me, I believe that it's policing is where it starts. So that's where we have to look, and that's a huge piece of it. And also when people come in for sentencing, there are large sentencing disparities. And so that causes racial disparities. The racial disparities in sentencing, it's another piece. And then on the back end, the issues that I've been working with the WISM statewide post-release issues work group, we see racial disparities again on the back end. So at all levels of the system, on the front end, in prison, and on the back end, there are huge racial disparities across the system, and there's a lot of work to be done. A lot needs to be changed around that.
Indeed. So much about the numbers for me. It's quite clear that we have these issues, we have these problems. The racial disparities exist, but so much of it comes down to, you know, cultural sensitivity, cultural differences. There are a lot of abstracts built into all of this, but for me, it comes down to when we're looking at the different mechanisms that exist from elementary school on up. There are these fast tracks that turn young people and adolescent behavior into criminality. That gets them into the system overall. That gets them a number. That number, of course, is how they're tracked when they actually go to prison, if they actually go to prison. But the thing about this number is that it's another way to shift resources out of keeping them home and turning them into community members as adults, training them for that. And it's more along the lines of putting them into juvenile detention facilities and turning them into battle-hardened people as kids. And we invest less when you have this number because we need to be investing more in you as an incarcerated person and less as a citizen.
Do both of you get a sense that we've reached a point simply because incarcerating people is so expensive all over the country that we're at a point in American society where you have people of all political persuasions saying, we've got to find an alternative here. We can't afford this anymore. Will that change things, Carl?
I would say yes, the short answer is that, you know, the conversation that's surrounding, you know, the moral compass stuff and whether or not it's the right thing to do is about economics. And a lot of people respond well to the economics because it hits people in suburban areas. It hits people outside of urban areas. But so much about this, there are these layered systemic oppressive practices that on its face you can't see. But when you put all of these different policies side by side, you see the oppressive nature of it. You see the racial part of it. And you see so much of how this works to to disenfranchise a particular group of people, particularly urban people, particularly minority people.
Mark, has the time come to change because it's expensive?
Definitely. The main concern for me is that mass incarceration is destroying human lives, it's tearing families apart and disrupting entire communities. But also we have to look at the opportunity cost and the huge amount of money that's being wasted to unnecessarily incarcerate individuals in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin now spends more money on corrections than on the University of Wisconsin system. That has to stop immediately. We need to be investing more in education in the University of Wisconsin system. And the opportunity costs, just locally, when we look at the huge amount of money being wasted on institutions like Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility, and the vast majority of individuals at that institution do not need to be there. Most people there are there only for allegedly violating rules of supervision that do not involve new crimes. It's people on supervision who are being reincarcerated for minor infractions like failing alcohol tests, missing appointments, crossing county lines. That has to stop. All of that money is being wasted to unnecessarily incarcerate people. Should instead be used to build safer, stronger, and healthier communities in Milwaukee. The money should be reinvested, especially in the neighborhoods that have been most disproportionately harmed by mass incarceration. Neighborhoods in Milwaukee in the 53206 zip code and surrounding zip codes, which we know have been the hardest hit neighborhoods, neighborhoods that have been devastated by mass incarceration. And there's a huge amount of suffering going on in these neighborhoods, and much of it's unnecessary. We need to be investing in creation of jobs, connecting people with jobs. We need to address poverty, education, healthcare, public transportation, all of these major areas. All of this money's being taken out of these areas when we're unnecessarily incarcerating people. So it's very important.
A lot of areas.
Yes.
It's a fairly big job, isn't it?
Yes.
Tell me more about crimeless revocation. You outlined what people are being put into the detention center for. Are they kept there for a long period of time? Do they see a lawyer? Do they go to trial on this? How does all of this work?
People now are being incarcerated in Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility, which is commonly known as MSDF. People are spending oftentimes more than 12 months there. Originally, it was built just to hold people for short periods of time for probation, parole, and extended supervision holds. It's for people who are violating rules of extended supervision, probation, and parole. Many times, people are brought in just on allegations that later turn out to be false. There's very little due process involved now. And in MSDF, the conditions are inhumane. 17 people have died in MSDF since it opened in 2001. Expo leader James Wilborn died there in 2015. He died due to heat exhaustion, and he was not able to get medications that he needed there. It gets very hot in MSDF in the summer. Temperatures can get well above 100 degrees. There's no air conditioning. The ventilation's very poor. Several other people died there because their medical or psychiatric conditions were left untreated or were just neglected by staff members. And so that's a huge problem. And people, it's a very depressing place. I was incarcerated there in 2007. I never got to see outside, never got to go outside. I never got to have any in-person visits. I was locked in a cell over 20 hours per day. When I first got there, I was forced to sleep on the floor in a cell designed for one man. There were three individuals in this one small cell. There's one bunk there. I was sleeping on what they call a boat on the floor of the cell next to the toilet, so it's very inhumane. There's still a lot of overcrowding there.
If I could speak to that, Kathleen. For me, I meet so many people, and it's unclear of how this amount of people get back into the system and get back into prison, even though they haven't, you know, technically committed a new crime. It's simply some sort of rules violation, and most times it's a very minor infraction of a rules violation. You have the situation where when you're going to court or you're going to trial, people look at it as beyond reasonable doubt, and that is a staple in the law and in the system. But that way of looking at evidence and looking at a situation legally does not apply to a person who's on parole or probation. It's simply a matter of rules. Mm-hmm. And those rules come from a category of being convicted, a convicted person and a felon as well. And if you are dealing with a probation parole officer or their supervisor or whomever who seems to look at that rule as a safety infraction, and they'll utilize their discretion
I see.
They will put you back in, and then you will go through the machine of a process. Most times people go back into prison. Sometimes they don't. But either way, you still find yourself in the situation where you both lost your job, you lost your home, you've lost the social credibility that you've built up since you left prison, and all of it turns out was for nothing. And the only sort of compensation that you would get from the system, community corrections, is an I'm sorry, and that's if you get that. So
what should be the penalty if it's a minor infraction? Should it be let go? Should you pay some kind of penalty if you're on parole?
Policymakers in Wisconsin should be connecting people with the help and services that they need in communities instead of reincarcerating individuals. Individuals should have the opportunity to continue to work and to continue. People should continue to live with their families. We should not be tearing families apart and keeping people away from their jobs. And there are many community-based alternatives that we know work. Just want to get back to some of the overall numbers so people can understand how huge of a problem this is. Expo and Wisdom recently partnered with an organization in Oakland called Human Impact Partners to do a health impact assessment about the consequences of excessive revocations in Wisconsin. We found that in 2015 alone, Wisconsin incarcerated 3,000 individuals for crimeless revocations. Now there are 4,500 people in the Wisconsin state prison system who are there because of a revocation that did not involve a new crime. That's more than the combined capacity of MSDF and the state's two largest prisons. There's a huge amount of unnecessary incarceration going on, and revocations create instability in individuals' lives that makes it more likely that they'll commit more crimes. Where when people face instability in employment and housing and are torn away from their families, that's going to lead to increased recidivism. We have to be focused on reducing recidivism rates and keeping communities safe and healthy. And we found that revocations harm the health of individuals, communities, and families. So it was led by the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. You can find it online at simpback.org. Expo has recently started a campaign that aims to close Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility. The campaign kickoff event will be on Thursday, June 29th. It will start at 5 p.m. June 29th at the downtown campus of Milwaukee Area Technical College, room M605. We'll have a film premiere there. Tim Corson, who's an independent producer, is making a short documentary film about MSDF. We're going to have a panel discussion led by Expo to respond to that. And we have Janos Martin coming from an organization called Just Leadership USA. He managed the Close Rikers campaign in New York City, which got a commitment from Mayor de Blasio there to close Rikers. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to be marching to MSDF, which is a few blocks down the street. And we're going to have a prayer vigil for all the individuals who've died in MSDF and a short rally and press conference after that. So please come out and support us. We've got a strong coalition of organizations in Milwaukee that already support this campaign, like Milwaukee NAACP, UBLAC, IWW Milwaukee, Table of Saints, MICA, Wisdom, Rid Racism Milwaukee, just to name a few. And so if you want to get more involved, you can reach us at expogroupwi@gmail.com. or find us on Twitter at Expo Wisconsin or Facebook at Expo Wisconsin. So please come out and get involved. There's definitely strength in numbers, and we need as much community involvement on this as possible.
Let's talk about both of your situations, and you obviously have worked with many formerly incarcerated people. Tell me about how fragile a life is, your lives are, if you want to talk personally about this, when you leave a prison situation. And because we've talked about this not often with people who are formerly incarcerated, we talk about it in terms of a society, what do we need to do in terms of getting jobs for people. We've already talked about the support that may be needed, but what did both of you need in order to move ahead with your lives and to, you know, to be sitting on the radio right now talking about all of these very important issues? Who needed to help? What needed did you need to lift you up?
Well, definitely support, family, community, having a certain awareness about what's available, especially with housing. Housing is a staple. So many people struggle with that. At the least, quite a few people releasing from prisons and jails are in a situation where they may actually have somewhere to go, but it's not a good environment for them mm-hmm. to go to. And short of that, they'll have to, you know, sleep on the street or be homeless or go to a homeless shelter, which is perhaps an even worse situation. So with that, we definitely need programs about transitional housing, but the reasonable type of transitional housing. And of course, there's a cost involved, but there's quite a cost to keeping them in prison. The cost that keeps them home, keeps them in an alternative of some kind, whether it's a behavioral health or a mental health or an ALDA, you know, alternative. All of those are fractions of the cost still of keeping them in prison. For me, my struggle came so much from leaving prison with medical issues, not having those addressed, being more or less pushed out of the door, and coming home and trying to transition into a regular life with the expectations of both society, family, and the parole and probation office, and not being able to meet most of those needs because of both my condition and not being prepared out here mm-hmm. to do all of this. And for me, I had both the support of my family. I had a reasonable person in community correction, reasonable persons, plural. They do exist. That coupled with the fact that so many people who surrounded me, both with Project Return, with Expo, with Racine Interfaith Coalition, they were all supportive of the fact that we want to see you home and we also want to keep you home. Mm-hmm. So the bridges that I didn't know about, they either showed me where they were or they helped me to build some. You know, in accordance with my unique situation. But so much of it is about people around you, organizations around you, having a willingness to accept you as a returning person with the expectation that you can make it.
Mm-hmm. Mark, how about you?
I've been able to succeed because I've been exposed to exceptional opportunities. I believe that all formerly incarcerated people should be given similar opportunities that I've been given. That's missing right now. Right now, formerly incarcerated people face significant barriers to successful reentry, especially in housing, employment, education. People need all of this in order to be able to do, people need this to succeed when they get out.
Sure.
It's very important that individuals have access to stable housing, access to living wage employment, access to educational opportunities. And that's, like I said, missing in many cases right now. Society has created barriers for people in getting these basic needs met when they first get out. And that's one of the things that Expo has taken on. We joined a national campaign that aimed to get President Obama to ban the box for federal jobs and for federal contractors in 2015. That's a box on job applications that inquires about conviction and arrest records. And we were joined a national coalition of formerly incarcerated leaders that organized around that. We reached out to state and local elected officials in Wisconsin and got them to sign on to a request to the president. We participated in a ban the box rally at the White House and met with some of the president's policy advisors around that. We also did some local actions around against companies that had federal contracts, and eventually President Obama banned the box for federal jobs in 2015. In my case, I'll get back to that. I also had support from my family, which was very important. My mom was very supportive when I first got out, and that's very important that individuals have some type of social support network when they first get out. And for me, the main issue is reducing barriers to successful reentry, because we know when people have access to living wage employment and stable housing, people are less likely to return to prison, much less likely, and that's a very important piece of creating safer, healthier, and stronger communities. We have to invest in the success of people with conviction and arrest records, and we know that's going to help us to build stronger communities.
Let's welcome phone calls, and we'll do so in just one moment. Our number is, we have a lot of you calling in already. I wasn't looking. I'm sorry. I always intended to invite you into the conversation. We just got rolling here on our own conversation, but we'll be with you just momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Mark Rice is with us. He chairs the Revocations Workgroup of Wisdom, which is a faith-based organization in this state working to end mass mass incarceration. They have a number of issues that you've heard him outline, and our other guest as well, Carl Fields, a board member of Expo Wisconsin and the chair of the Racine Interfaith Coalition's Restore Our Community Task Force. What do we do about mass incarceration? What about this issue, and maybe it's new to some of you, of crimeless revocation in the Milwaukee Secure Detention facility, where a number of people have died? The conditions are not very good, and to say the least, and people are there sometimes for a year period of time, and that may be for a very slight infraction on probation or parole. So we have a lot to discuss. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Kathy in West Bend, our first caller for you, gentlemen. Hello, Kathy.
Good afternoon. I want to both agree and disagree with your guest. I'm a retired parole and probation officer. I do believe that there are people who may not have been convicted ever committed a crime, but frankly, do need to be removed from society. There are victims who are terrorized by someone, but somehow nobody's been convicted yet. There are those types of things when all else fails, and I emphasize that, when all else fails, some people just need to be kept away from the rest of the world. That being said, I really think that both the Department of Corrections and society in general can do one heck of a lot more to be non-racist, anti-offender. I still, unfortunately, still use that word. They need to realize that treatment programs need to be located where the jobs are and vice versa. Persons who come out of prison can't get a lot of the opportunities that others have because of their felony conviction. And it's frustrating as the devil to realize that so much could be done. There are programs the state has wasted money on, and they are not helping the individuals, and in some cases are extremely discriminatory against people of color.
Kathy, let's go back to what you said a little bit earlier. When you talked about people who are dangerous, who need to be just put away, were you specifically referencing the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility?
As to where they should be locked away?
Right. I mean, people who are out of being incarcerated and who may have committed some kind of infraction of parole and probation. What do you think about the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility?
Well, my last several years as a DOC employee, I was not involved too much with MSDF.
I see.
But I did work in Milwaukee for a number of years, and the MSDF was somewhat new then. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of hope for it. Mm-hmm. I can see that if it would be overcrowded, mm-hmm. it would be detrimental to people. But
okay, thank you very much. Who wants to respond first, if both of you do?
I'll respond first.
Mark, go ahead.
Simply reincarcerating individuals for minor infractions is not going to solve the problem. We need to look at the underlying causes of the behavior. Many times people have substance abuse problems, people are suffering from mental illness, people are poor, people are unemployed, people have a number of problems. And a key part of the health impact assessment that Human Impact Partners did with Expo and Wisdom, it showed that simply reincarcerating people for technical violations makes communities less safe because of the instability it's causing in individuals' lives. In some cases, in other states, it's the length of time of reincarceration that we also need to look at. Some states have started to implement what they call quick dips, which is just a one or two short stay in jail, which would be a county jail. And that has been a successful part of a strategy to help people succeed in some cases. So it could be we want to greatly limit the use of incarceration. So just by doing that, by greatly limiting the use of jail time as a sanction, right now Wisconsin can incarcerate people for up to 90 days for sanctions, and for revocations the time can be, in my case I was facing 12 years, and so we're talking about huge lengths of time. The average time that a person was sent back for a revocation in 2015 was 18 months, and that's a huge amount of time. It's really devastating to an individual. An individual is going to lose jobs, and you know, the person will lose a job, will lose housing, will lose family relationships, and it's going to make it very hard to succeed once an individual comes back from that. And there's so many community-based alternatives that are much better than incarcerating people that we need to look into, and other states are doing that. Other states have been implementing graduated sanctions. Wisconsin has ATRs, alternative to revocation programs. Mm. They have a system of graduated sanctions right now that they're implementing. They need to make greater use of it, and it can't just resort to incarceration as a first response. And it's not always just a first response. Sometimes there are violations, and people are going to have violations. We need to realize that. It's going to be a process, but the DOC should not just resort to incarceration so quickly. And we need to understand that people are going through several challenges, many of the problems that I mentioned before, and those issues have to be addressed, and we should be focusing on getting individuals the help that they need in communities, and when there's more of a focus on that. And I want to challenge the caller on the use of the term offender. That's part of the problem, that the DOC is not treating individuals like humans, and that's the first step to solving this problem, is that Department of Corrections has to stop using dehumanizing language like offender and ex-felon, all these words, all these dehumanizing hate words, hate speech that they're using. That's the first part of the problem that I think needs to be addressed. When DOC starts treating people on supervision as human beings, as when they start to look at us as human beings, assets to communities and members of family, that's going to change. There's got to be a shift in culture, a shift in language. And without that, we're not going to see the change that we need. We're going to see people being unnecessarily incarcerated for minor infractions. Continue on. Hey,
thank you for that, Mark. That's exactly what I wanted to say, which was a shift in narrative. So much for me, and Kathy touched on a couple of good points and some interesting points that I, you know, take issue with, but creative differences. Part of this problem is that the alternatives to incarceration and the way that we use this money and the way that we look at people both inside of prison and releasing is that all that fits currently within a tough on crime narrative. We need a sort of smart on crime narrative, but we need a buy-in. We need a community buy-in, and we need to be honest about ourselves that we are no longer in a rehabilitative focus when it comes to prisons and what they do in county jails and stuff like that. It's really not that anymore, but politically speaking, it's still being sold as that. So a lot of people who don't live this fight and do this fight think that we're still there, and we are not.
Yeah, interesting point. I want to spend a little bit of time before we go back to phone calls talking about mental illness. One of the guests that prompted today's show, actually, we were talking about the death of the inmate at the Milwaukee County Jail of dehydration who also had mental illness. I'm thinking of Dontre Hamilton. I'm thinking of a lot of people who have had substantial mental illness problems who have not been able to receive treatment. That system seems to be chaotic and not available to everybody, and as a result, some people wind up in jail because they're suffering from mental illness. Tell me what your knowledge is of this issue in prisons in the state of Wisconsin. Is it a widespread problem? Is there enough treatment in prison? Is there enough treatment when people get out? Could people escape going to prison, committing acts due perhaps in part to mental illness if there were a better system on the outside?
Yes, it's a huge problem. I'll start by sharing one of the numbers from our health impact assessment. We found that although only 18% of individuals in Wisconsin suffer from mental illness, 44% of the people who were sent back for crimeless revocations in 2015 suffer from mental illness.
That's a lot.
It's a huge disparity. And especially in county jails, Milwaukee County Jail, there's a huge problem with people with mental illnesses being unnecessarily incarcerated for behavior related to the mental illnesses that they suffer from. I've experienced it myself. I've been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. Milwaukee County has incarcerated me on several occasions for behavior related to my mental illness. When I was in MSDF, that was related to my mental illness. And so many times I was being incarcerated just because I was experiencing symptoms of disabling mental illness that I suffer from. Mm-hmm. And instead of getting treatment and help that I needed in the community, the Department of Corrections unnecessarily incarcerated me in MSDF for 6 months. I've spent time in Milwaukee County system as well, so I'm familiar with that system. And the last place that we should be sending people with mental illnesses is MSDF or the Milwaukee County Jail. There's got to be a shift in how these problems are dealt with. Milwaukee County is starting to address it now with the funding that they received from the MacArthur Foundation. There's some initiatives going on that while hopefully will be small steps in the right direction if they're implemented properly. But we've got to stay on top of that and stay on top of our county officials and make sure those are implemented properly and have the intended effect. And in MSDF, it's a torture chamber. MSDF devastates individuals psychologically. I stayed in the special needs unit while I was there. Nearly all of the people there have disabling mental illnesses, and the people who don't have disabling mental illnesses have disabling physical conditions. And I saw that this institution was devastating individuals psychologically. One man in the institution committed suicide.
Oh my.
Several men in my unit had to be put under suicide watch. Mm. A couple of guys in my unit severely mutilated themselves. It's a very traumatic and stressful experience for me. It was one of the worst experiences of my life. Out of the four prisons I've been incarcerated at, MSDF was by far the worst. It's an inhumane institution, and it needs to be shut down.
Indeed. For me, so much about all this is behavioral health and mental health as well. When we're talking about addiction, so much of that is physical health, and you can see that. But when we're talking about mental health, when we're talking about PTSD, whether you got it from poverty or you got it in Iraq, I mean, it's a real thing. It's crippling, and it's the sort of thing that needs to be addressed, and it certainly serves the public and public safety much better to have that addressed on the outside, along with support systems to prop up the treatment than in prison, where you're trying to treat this person alone and you're doing so at a great cost to everyone.
Yeah. Pat sends this email. I have a nephew who's currently at Lincoln Hills. What would you say would be the best way that I can be supportive of his return? He is 19. He's been in Lincoln Hills for 3 years. Do you have youth groups with Project Return?
Yes, we have. We're affiliated with MICA's LIT program, Leaders Igniting Transformation, which was formerly the 53206 initiative. Dakota Hall is the organizer there. It's a youth organizing initiative, and Project Return helps any person who comes within the doors. So we don't turn, I'm on the board there, we don't turn away anyone.
Okay.
So we're one of the few organizations that will help anyone. We don't discriminate against people based on age or based on type of conviction record. And that's why one of the reasons why Project Return is one of the best organizations in this field. And so definitely there's support for young people. And I'll let Carl share more.
Well, for me, our ROC campaign throughout the state, I'm tied to it specifically out of Racine. And, of course, it stands for Restoring Our Communities. But in my community, we focus for quite a bit of time on the Treatment Instead of Prisons campaign, the TAD, Treatment Alternatives and Diversions campaign, and resources tied to that. But we've added a layer to that campaign, which is what we call the K-12 Initiative. That, of course, is school to prison pipeline stuff and how adolescent behavior is being criminalized at an alarming rate, particularly for minorities. But kids overall, when you're in a situation where you're releasing from a place where they treated you like an adult, you were isolated, and the choices that you had to make were simply about compliance, and then they release you into the society and they want you to act like an adult and a citizen, you have no compass for that. You have no frame of reference for that. So for me, I say a young person, 18, 19, in full transition, you allow for them to both be a child and an adult. You allow for them to make mistakes that help them build up and out. And you let them know that you understand, like Mark said, that those mistakes are going to happen because they're missteps trying to feel your way out into adulthood, and to support the idea that this young person can be active, that they can be more than just what they were told there. And they were simply told that because it fit with the institutional needs and not the person's needs.
Let's go to Nadine next in West Bend. Hi, Nadine. Nadine, are you there? Got to turn your radio down. We'll come back to you in a minute. Jim in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen, and thank you for the subject and the topic, and for the people that you have on the panel there. I have this, my mind is swimming with the I've spent 40 years in Illinois and now 40 years in Wisconsin. So that tells you my age.
You sound good, sir.
Indeed.
And I thank God every day that in my youth I had a loving family and people around me that supported me. And it wasn't, I mean, I screwed up many times. And I think today, I don't know, we don't have treatment. I don't hear about treatment on untreated mental illness in the jails. And my question is, why do we seem to incarcerate so many people in Wisconsin? And I do know the statistic that in Minnesota, there's about half of the people incarcerated. Maybe they're spending more time on rehabilitation and the root causes. You know, this school to the pipeline, school to jail, is terrible. You know, I just can't comprehend it. We need more help for people that need help, not sending them in jail and putting them in isolation, which is likened to torture.
Mark, you want to respond? Whoever wants to respond, go ahead.
Well, for me, I'd like to directly address that, Jim. For all of us in this work that we do, I would say in that comparison between Minnesota and us, you can simply come down to the systems, the mechanisms tied to the economics of prison and incarcerating people. With Minnesota, they have a situation where there's a buy-in both county-wise and state-wise. And in order for the county to send people to prison, they have to, you know, incur a certain amount of that cost, a percentage of that cost. With Wisconsin, a county can send a person to prison, and simply that cost is on the state. Now, if we had a system like that where the county had to incur a certain amount in sending persons back to prison, then there would be a disincentive to do that, and they would be looking for alternatives, and they would be building alternatives. And we would have 72 different alternatives to revocation programs and not just one. We would have a completely different system. But that aside, I guess for me, the alternative to that is that we've been looking to push a campaign that says that when a county can clearly show that they've produced an alternative to sending people to prison or sending people back to prison, that they be allowed to utilize some of those savings, some of those costs be funneled back directly to the county. And so if we could do something like that here, that would definitely change the amount of people that flow back to prison on a yearly basis.
Mark? What about nonviolent offenders? Does the state of Minnesota handle nonviolent offenders in a different way than Wisconsin does?
Minnesota implemented a Community Corrections Act in the early 1970s, as Carl was speaking about, which encouraged counties to create and implement more community-based alternatives to incarceration, and it created disincentives for counties to send people to prison for less than 5 years. Mm-hmm. Minnesota also enacted legally binding sentencing guidelines in the late 70s, early 80s that played a role in helping Minnesota to reduce prison populations. Minnesota tends to reserve prison space for people who have been convicted of the most heinous crimes, and they find alternatives for people who have been convicted of lower level offenses. Mm-hmm. And now Wisconsin incarcerates people at twice the rate of Minnesota, and Wisconsin spends more than twice as much on corrections as Wisconsin. And it's been that way since the 70s. And the opportunity costs over those decades is huge. That's all money that Wisconsin cannot be investing to build safer, stronger, and healthier communities in the neighborhoods that have been most disproportionately harmed by mass incarceration. And that's something that has to be considered and looked at when we look at the opportunity costs and all that, that over time has put Wisconsin in a much worse position than Minnesota. And a key point is also that crime rates in Minnesota and Wisconsin have stayed the same over those since the 1970s, over all this time. And Minnesota and Wisconsin have very similar populations, similar demographics, are similar in a lot of different ways. And so it forms sort of a natural experiment when we look at the two states, and Wisconsin has a lot of work to do in this area. Overcriminalization up front is another problem. Many people are criminalized for just because of being poor, living in poverty, because of race, because of mental illness. Many people should never be put in the system in the first place, and that's another piece that we can't ignore or overlook. That, and we don't want to widen the net. We don't want to, in Wisconsin has far too many people on extended supervision for far too long. And then when people are on extended supervision, people can be sent back to prison for things that most people do every day and take for granted, as we spoke of earlier about the situation with revocations. And so Wisconsin has widened the net with the Truth in Sentencing program. They're giving people very long sentences in conjunction with very long extended sentences in the community on supervision, what is called extended supervision now. And that's another part of the problem. And Minnesota has what they call sanctions conferences, which in Minnesota, the probation agents there have to consider a wide range of alternative sanctions or alternative responses to incarcerated individuals before going through the just straight to revocation and reincarcerating people. And there are examples of states all over the country that have greatly reduced the use of incarceration for crimeless revocations. And many states have been able to close down prisons mostly because of that policy change. This is a key area.
More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, let's try Nadine again in West Bend. Hi, Nadine.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay, I guess I don't know if it's a comment or what, but I was listening to this for over half an hour driving to an appointment. When I was 11, and my mother died, and I was sent to foster care, what the system did during that time was almost what I'm listening to as adults. I ended up in 3 girls' homes, 14 foster homes, I had no criminal record, nothing. They just didn't know what to do. Detention home for children, 9 times. And by the time I was 18, no education whatsoever, nothing like anything formal for me to fit in was unbelievable for most of my life. What I'm listening to, I guess it struck a nerve. I just can't believe all this. How horrible. I mean, these people, there are people that do things wrong, but some of this stuff, these people do need rehabilitation. They need to be thought about, especially in health or mental illness or like what they're talking about, just getting pulled out of probation and paroled due to a simple error or something, an appointment. I mean, I've seen it. I've seen it most of my life, and I've lived it. And it even came into my adult life, how it affected me through school, through any jobs. All that stuff keeps getting brought up. And to this day, I still go back and forth to treatment.
I'm sure you do. What a life you've had. What a hard, hard life. Respond to Nadine.
Well, thank you for that, Nadine. That certainly is what I've been looking at and we're seeing, and we've been looking at statewide with the ROC campaign. So much of the ROC campaign for me is addressing these sorts of concerns on the front end, and it's just not the back end. A person like myself, I'm on the back end of that arc. A young person like Nadine, and during that time, was definitely on the front end. But for me, it's so crucial to help those young people because they don't see what this is and what this amounts to, and the layered barriers that come along with simple infractions, and how to prevent that. Well-off people know how to protect their kids from things like that, which is why economics play a factor in all of this. And this is why wealthy kids tend to sidestep that. Even though the judge is sitting there on the bench, he also sometimes reveals personal pieces of himself that say, I can identify with that. But sometimes situations like that, they were protected, and economically so.
Yeah. It's hard to identify with what she's been through. Holy cow. It's really hard to turn your life around. All right, we've got about a minute left. You've got a conference coming up. You want to tell us? It's in June, right? You've got something coming up you want to let people know about?
The Close MSDF Action. We have an event it's the Close MSDF campaign launch event on Thursday, June 29th.
Okay.
It starts at 5 p.m. at Milwaukee Area Technical College, downtown campus, room M605.
Okay.
Then we'll be marching to MSDF at 6 for a prayer vigil for the individuals who died there, a rally and short press conference. Please come out and support us on Thursday, June 29th at 5 p.m., Milwaukee Area Technical College, downtown campus, room M605.
Thank you both very much for being with us this hour. It was very enlightening, and all the best in the days and years ahead to both of you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Our thanks to Mark Rice, chairing the Revocations Work Group of Wisdom. And we also thank Carl Fields, board member of Expo Wisconsin, chair of the Racine Interfaith Coalition's Restore Our Communities group. And thanks to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour, Colleen Leahy for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. If you didn't get on air, we'd love to read your messages on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook. Until tomorrow.